people hurting, and they can't afford to hire an attorney, and you settle with them for a penny on the dollar. If that happens, I'm going to be here, unless I do something else, but I'm going to be here unless someone gets rid of me. And I can assure you, with the chairman from Louisiana and the rest of this committee, if you think the day's rough, just try doing something that those lawyers suggested you don't have to do. I'm going to give you one bit of advice if you're a lawyer. Don't listen to your legal beagles today.
I don't. I'm sure I've said enough in the past 2 weeks, so a lot of them probably may have already resigned, but that's not part of my...
To give you an idea, the reason I'm saying that, I'm aware, and I think you've handled yourself very well. And I believe you're sincere and you're an honorable person.
Absolutely.
But you have certain groups of people that aren't on the firing line that are now, and I've heard this from the backgrounds of different meetings I've had already, now
that this person didn't work well, and the log, the chronology we have indicates that this person did not, in fact, there were two or three attempts, that in fact we're going to lose about 7 million gallons of this spill one way or another, are not going to recover it. That our skimmers were overloaded because the oil was of a higher viscosity than we thought, or than someone expected, that perhaps Exxon was late in its response, that perhaps we had three generals in charge, as my colleague from Alaska has said, instead of one, and et cetera, et cetera. What this adds up to me is a rather large black list of mistakes that are all correctable. And what I'm hoping we are going to be able to do, and what I believe we must do, and what I'm asking for your comment on, is can you assist us with legislation to correct those things so that these are not unforeseen, that these are things that we are prepared to cope with. I'm sure we'll have a debate about whether it should be done by private enterprise or whether it should be done under a federal program. I would prefer, obviously, the former. I think those are the things we have to tend to, because this terrible tragedy has given us the opportunity to do something right, and we've got to do it. Are those observations that I've made things that you believe are correctable?
Well, I think the direction of your observation is very correct. I don't have any problem with it. I do have a problem thinking that perhaps legislation will correct this, quote, black list of things. Legislation will not correct the technology of being able to pick up oil. It will not correct the fact that oil gets viscous in very cold weather. It will not correct the fact that it's almost impossible to logistically have boom ready in all of the isolated places the tankers may be, including hundreds of miles at sea and collisions happening. So there's some of the things that you would like to do and I would like to do that legislation isn't going to do, and it may be part of the cost of living in the world that we live in. But some things need to be done and can be done, and we ought to work closely, you in the Congress and me in the administration, to do those things that make sense and not to respond with legislation that may not be helpful in the long run.
I accept that. We certainly would do better to pass no laws than to pass the wrong ones. But what you're indicating to me is that some type of cleanup, perhaps all cleanup, may be impossible under certain circumstances. And if that is true, then I think we have a much larger dilemma on our hands.
I would propose to you that 1,000 miles off of New York, 500 miles off of New York, two tankers colliding, each having 50 million gallons of oil, and putting 100 million gallons 100 miles off of New York in the middle of the winter. I don't think that any legislation or anything that you or I would do are going to clean that up. I don't know how to do that. We need some kind of a magnet, an oil magnet, that will pull that stuff back in the tank once it's spilled. The technology isn't there to do it. The technology is there to move the oil, but not to clean up those kinds of spills.
I appreciate your comments, and I think that is part of our dilemma, and I think that perhaps part of the answer may lie in a higher motivation and accountability for those people who are responsible for the spills.
Yeah, I agree with that, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. The last round of questions, I'm pleased to recognize the former chairman of this subcommittee as well, Mr. Jerry Studs of Massachusetts.
Admiral, I hope you don't interpret the fact that we're going to release you to the Senate as an indication of a premature judgment on our part of your misbehavior. And notwithstanding that, I'm going to be very brief, concentrate on two areas, if I may. One, liability. General questions of liability, and one questions of federal licensing pilots. In your judgment, who should be held liable for the damages incurred as a result of this spill? notwithstanding that, I'm going to be very brief, concentrate on two areas, if I may, one liability.
We've held Exxon liable for it. They've agreed to liability up to this point. I would hope that we don't have to hold the taxpayer liable to some extent at the end, but so far, Exxon has taken liability.
I agree with you, but isn't it true that under the TAPS law, liability shall not be imposed on the owner or on the TAPS fund, for that matter,
if it's proven that the damages were caused by the negligence of the United States or of some U.S. government agency?
I'm told that's absolutely correct, sir.
Given that, and given the fact that we have heard so far, I think Exxon's president blamed the Coast Guard for not giving permission for the use of dispersants, and given the fact that the Coast Guard didn't warn the tanker that it was off course, seems to me at least conceivable, given the amount of money Exxon presumably has available to retain counsel, that under existing federal law, notwithstanding their current disclaimers, we face the possibility that claims related to this spill could be tied up for years, if not decades, to come, and that Uncle Sam could ultimately get stuck with all or part of the bill, and people who should be compensated will not be, at least for a very long period of time. My question is, do you discount that possibility?
No, I don't.
Okay. Do you not agree that that very fact is, in and of itself, a very strong argument for strengthening federal law, to be sure that in an instance such as this, it's the polluter and not the government that pay?
My question is, do you discount that? That's probably beyond my my knowledge, but I don't see any problem with that. Obviously, I haven't thought it through, sir.
That may be a more appropriate question for the Secretary, but obviously those of us who have been trying to get such a law, comprehensive oil spill law, which we now count, I don't know, five or six commandants ago, those efforts began. I don't know how many secretaries of transportation. I do know how many presidents. It was a very long time ago.
The secretary has told me that he firmly supports this, and he's asked me to allow him to discuss this when he gets here, and he will do that in a very positive way.
I'm glad to hear that. We'll ask him very quickly on another subject, on pilotage and requirements for federal licenses of pilots in this area. As I understand it, one of our problems was not so much that the captain of the vessel was on the deck, but that he wasn't on the deck. We don't know what condition he was in at the time, but he was not on the deck where he should, by law, have been. It's my understanding that in June of last year, DOT Coast Guard published in the Federal Register a supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking entitled Licensing of Pilots, Manning a Vessel's Pilots. And in those proposed rules, there were some exemptions proposed to the pilotage requirements, to the requirement of a federally licensed officer on the bridge. And if I'm correct, and this is what I'd like you to tell me, if that proposed regulation of the Coast Guard's had become final, the master would not have been required to have been on the bridge when the Exxon Valdez had the accident. Is that correct?
Licensed officer on the bridge. And if I'm correct, and I'd like you to tell me, if that...
Let me ask the Vice Commandant to discuss that. He's probably better versed than I am in that.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that there was indeed a proposed rule such as has been suggested here. And my understanding of that is that the conclusion that Mr. Studs has just made would be correct, that had that rule become final, that indeed the master or someone with a pilot's license would not have had.
Where in bureaucratic rulemaking limbo is that rule at the moment?
I don't know, sir.
Oh. Well, who might, do you suppose?
We can find out, sir. I just don't know.
Well, it's a Coast Guard proposal, is it not?
It was a Coast Guard proposal, sir.
Is it still a Coast Guard proposal?
It's not at this moment, sir.
It's a rather interesting thing to note, sir.
I think counsel is leading the witness.
Yeah. I suggest that we launch a SAR mission, Admiral.
It is rather interesting.
We can't locate that.
I will set out a SAR team for it. You seem to be leading the witness here somewhat,
sir. It's a rather interesting thing to note, sir.
Well, gosh. I thank you. I don't know what's the appropriate valedictory for someone who's being sentenced to a trip to the Senate, but we wish you well and go as heavily armed as you can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I hope you fare better than your proposed rule on the Senate side, Admiral. We're pleased now indeed to release you, Admiral, to the Senate. One series of requests. One, Ms. Snyder has requested that the Coast Guard supply to her, in her role on the technology subcommittee as well, information regarding the technology issues involved in this cleanup, and if you would be so kind as to communicate with her.
We'd be very happy to submit that.
And secondly, I've received requests from some of the other members who have not had a chance at a round of questioning yet, that you allow someone with the Coast Guard to stay in case there are questions we want to refer to the Coast Guard. Before you leave,
I would like to leave my vice commandant and when my secretary gets here, I think you'll find him very capable of answering.
And finally, Admiral, we're not, of course, going to leave it here. We want to put you all on notice that at some point in the not too distant future, we want to wrap up session. We'd like you to return at your convenience. We'll schedule a time for you. Well, we can get a full report on what indeed has happened. What changes are you prepared to recommend to us following your Board of Inquiry? And indeed, whether or not this thing is going to be concluded successfully or we need some continuing legislation to deal with it. Admiral, thank you again and to all of your staff. I know these have been trying times for you, for your staff. Be assured that this subcommittee is not going to allow people to beat up unmercifully upon you when they have not resourced you properly in this and other areas. Thank you
very much.
Well, thank you again, and to all of your staff. I know these have been trying times for you. The chair now calls the Honorable Steve McAlpin, the Lieutenant Governor of the State of Alaska, and the Honorable John Devins, the Mayor of the City of Valdez, to the witness table. With the understanding that for the committee's purposes, that we will continue receiving testimony, and we will continue, by the way, with the line of questionings rotating as we have begun until we've completed a round, so that those of you who have been waiting will have a chance for questions. And we'll continue until noon, when we'll take a short half-hour recess. Should the Secretary of Transportation arrive at any time, we will interrupt the hearing at that point to take his testimony so that we can indeed get to room. If you would make room, perhaps we'll now invite the Secretary of Transportation, who has arrived from his Joseph Conrad trip to the Senate. And we now welcome our new Secretary of Transportation, Mr. Samuel Skinner. Mr. Secretary, we're pleased to have you here today. We know again that these are trying times for you in the new Administration of Transportation. This is your first appearance before our committee, and we wish that we're on better times and occasions than this, but we welcome you, and we invite your comments first about this tragedy in Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, appreciate the fact that the committee has moved so quickly to deal with the issue. As you probably know now, I did travel to Alaska a week ago Tuesday to view firsthand with Administrator Riley and Commandant Yost not only the situation on scene but the environment in which this catastrophe took place. Having never been to that part of Alaska, I was impressed with its beauty, and I was impressed with the enormity of the spill. 10 million gallons is not only the largest spill in domestic history, but it's one of the largest in world history. Most of that spill occurred in the first 5 hours, and almost all of the 10 million gallons was in the water within the first 10. It is quite clear to me, as the mayor has indicated, that the contingency plan in place and approved by various state and federal offices was not nearly adequate to deal with the problem, even if it had responded, even if the program had been put into place within the 5 hours it had anticipated. It is beautiful, but it is somewhat remote. The logistics of supporting Valdez and Cordova are not insignificant, and it appears to me that as we look in hindsight, we will make some significant recommendations. The President has already ordered a review of the contingency plan process and ordered that report to be back to him within the next couple of weeks to make sure we are doing everything we can to learn from this experience. But now we are faced with an enormous event that we must deal with, I think, on two immediate fronts. Number one, to make sure the damage to the environment in the industry is contained as best as can be in this situation. It is a very difficult problem to contain. There is no magic answer. There is no wand, no, you know, $1 million of expenditures or the expenditures of efforts of thousands of people that will automatically guarantee that this problem will be controlled. We must contain it. We are looking to the industries of Alaska, the fishing industry, the officials from the state of Alaska, for their advice on what areas need to be protected. My assessment is that, to some degree, those efforts on protecting the fish hatcheries have been somewhat successful. But we now have oil on all of the islands, and in addition to the impact it will have on the fishing industry, which is impossible to predict at this time, we have an environmental effect that is going to take months to correct on an extended period of time. It is fortunate in some respects that the tanker was owned by a major company which has major resources. It is our responsibility to make sure that those resources are properly deployed and as quick and as quickly as possible. That is a problem and a challenge that we are attempting to deal with on a daily basis. And as the oil moves, the target moves, and we must be ready to react. The second issue is one that the mayor and I'm sure the lieutenant governor discussed before I arrived, and that's the impact on the industry in Alaska. We have discussed that with the president personally. I have discussed that with the senior officials of Exxon, who I am in daily contact with. I have indicated to them that it is, in my opinion, not only as Secretary of Transportation, but as someone who was in private practice not too long ago advising corporations of this magnitude, that it is in their best interest, given the clear liability that exists here, that they make every reasonable effort as soon as possible to assure the industry in Alaska, particularly Valdez and Cordova and those other communities that may be affected, that the promises of fair restitution for any damages is real, not illusory. That continues to be a top priority of mine. I spoke with the president of Exxon last night on my suggestion of the establishment immediately of a fund that would immediately make available these funds to the industry. It is clear that it is impossible to predict with any degree of regularity or certainty the impact on the fishing industry, but I suggest that we must work, and I think, and I'm hopeful, we will have some program in place in the not-too-distant future that will assure the industry that if they make reasonable claims and reasonable process, that they will be protected, and that their vessels, their families, and their communities will be protected. I look forward to reporting back to this committee in the future on the progress of that. If we don't see that, it will be my recommendation to the president that we take other steps quickly to ensure that those industries will not be impacted and will not be financially strapped. Now let's go to the issue of what we can learn from this. We can learn from the response that the contingency plan was not adequate. It dealt with a spill one-third the size of this one. We have to do better and improve that. And Administrator Riley and I are charged with the responsibility of responding to the president with recommendations in the very near future. Number two, the legislation that exists on the books of today does not go far enough in assuring that the industry and the people of Alaska and other countries and other states are protected in the future on a spill of this magnitude. This committee has worked diligently with the Department of Transportation in putting together spill legislation in the past. I think that effort must go forward. We must reach closure with the Senate and get some meaningful liability legislation on the books that, number one, fixes liability both domestically and internationally, allows for collection of those judgments, and creates a sufficient fund that if this were to happen, again, heaven forbid, that the and it were a small company with no real assets, that the injury involved would be restitution would be made based on that injury to those injured parties. With that in mind, I would entertain any questions, and of course I'm accompanied by Vice Commandant who will answer any other questions that I might have of a particular nature.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Secretary, right before you arrived, we heard from the Lieutenant Governor and the Mayor of the City of Valdez, and both have indicated that for 3 days, under absolutely ideal conditions, Prince William Sound, that booming operations could, in fact, have contained a great deal of the oil, in their opinion, and that obviously responses were not quick enough to take advantage of that good weather in booming that oil. You've been there. You've obviously been in contact with Exxon officials. Can you comment on that assertion that the governor and the mayor have made?
Well, first of all, and I've talked to the experts on this subject. I don't pretend to be an expert, although I've interviewed and put on the stand expert witnesses for years. In my opinion, the best time to contain a spill of this magnitude is within the first few hours around the ship. Once it gets out, you must protect the spill and protect the areas that are designated sensitive areas with protective boom, and then you must put sorbent boom into place to recover some. But the massive area that this is now covered, to think that we can boom and skim this in short order, I think is unrealistic. Every expert tells me that. The best example I can think of is that when someone takes this floor out in front of us, if that was the water, and drops a pencil in there and says that's the impact all the booming we could possibly conceive would have as far as the area that it would enclose, so you've got to be sensitive on it. Skimming is most difficult at this stage. Skimming works best when you have it a heavy slick and it's contained. Skimmers at best work at 500 gallons an hour. We're talking about 10 million gallons that's now spread and moosed all over Prince William Sound. And what we're in for is a protective booming effort, a skimming where it can be done, and there are virtually dozens of skimmers either there or on the way, sorbent boom around the protected areas, a containment boom where appropriate, and constantly moving target as weather dictates the flow of the oil. So it is not an easy problem at this stage. It is not one that is subject to quick fixes. We are in this for the duration. The administration recognizes that. Every available resource that needs to be placed in Alaska under the United States Coast Guard is there. I have literally said to the Coast Guard, we can't let budget or other things get in the way. Let's make the all-out effort necessary. And we virtually have a good portion of the Coast Guard available or working on this problem. If we need additional resources, they'll be there. And I have confidence that the House and the Senate will help me through my budget problems if that occurs later on. That is not going to be a problem.
I'm not at all questioning whether or not this thing is out of hand now, that booming can't accomplish a cleanup or that we're not doing everything we can now. The question is, it's one raised by the governor and the mayor, did Exxon drop the ball in the first 3 days when booming could have been effective? And in regard to that, if it is true that it dropped the ball, what's wrong with our response mechanisms that allowed this spill to get out of hand and become as big a mess as it is today?
The answer to the first question is yes, the industry, not just Exxon, the industry has a responsibility up there, and the industry response was not on time and not consistent with plan, and the plan itself was inadequate to deal with this problem. I think, as Governor Cooper told me when I met with him in Alaska the first 3 days, there was not a coordinated effort, and that was what the basis upon his request for federalization. He withdrew that request and said we should hold that in abeyance when he said, because he told me personally that on Monday night he believed it was beginning to come together, and that the resources necessary to marshal in there were there and that they were beginning to go into place. He has now made a new request, as you know. The problem is changing as the as it moves. That his observations and request is being evaluated on a daily basis by us. We've never said we would not change our response as the problem changes, but the industry needs to go back to, frankly, to ground zero and reevaluate how they're going to deal with a spill of this magnitude. And I think we're going to learn at the federal government level as well.
One final one, and we're going to start around on here. In your opinion, as Secretary of the Department of Transportation, have we resourced our Coast Guard adequately to deal with spills of this nature?
Well, there's no question that, and I've said this in my confirmation hearing, we've asked the Coast Guard to assume new missions, and we haven't properly funded it. A significant member of the budget committee from the House, a very significant member, told me in a hearing that I had on appropriations that he admitted that he had shortchanged transportation in general. That shortchange is not the right word. I don't want to put words in his mouth. That he had cut the budget significantly of the transportation-related agencies, including the Coast Guard. So that's a problem we're going to have to deal with in the next budget cycle. The President has recognized it and asked for more funding. Right now, however, the funding that we're really just putting resources in there, even though I recognize I'm going to have some severe budget problems as a result, but we'll deal with that at a later date.
Governor, one question. I've been told that the city of Valdez and the Alyeska Pipeline Company applied for a permit 3 years ago to build a warehouse to house barge and additional cleanup equipment. Was that permit denied? And if so, why?
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company maintained full-time personnel who acted much as a fire crew. Their duties were to shine the equipment, go out, engage in drills and testing and that sort of thing. And at about that time, some consideration was given that they no longer needed the strike force type of group, and they disbanded it and chose rather to train in-house the operational personnel there at the pipeline terminal facility. At that point in time, I was the mayor of Valdez, and John was on the city council, and as a matter of fact, just about a week or 10 days ago, we were engaged in a discussion about how we had been concerned about that, and we made an offer to warehouse. It wasn't seeking a permit, but literally warehouse all of the types of material that would be necessary to attack a large-scale spill. Booms, dispersants, they told us that that would be a tremendous waste of city money.
Who told you it would be a waste?
Alyeska personnel, and I hate to use a name. I've got a specific person in mind right now, but I would hate to use his name if, in fact, he wasn't the one. But when a private industry comes to an elective body and tells you not to spend money, that in fact it would be a waste of spending money, you can imagine how that affected members of the city council.
Governor, there's some confusion in the facts we have. We were speaking of an incident in 86 where the city and Alyeska combined in a permit request that we heard was denied, and that sounded strange to me, and I wanted to know if you had any information on that, Mayor.
I think maybe what you're thinking of is 86 or 87, the city of Valdez posed an increase in tax on the Alyeska facility. That increase in tax was to be used for doing exactly what the lieutenant governor described back 7 or 8 years ago. We wanted to stockpile the materials. We wanted to have emergency measures in place in the event of a major spill. We didn't feel that we received much cooperation at that time from Alyeska, but it really wasn't their decision to make whether or not we would do that or not. It was a tax that we imposed on them, and quite frankly, that was challenged by the state of Alaska because there is a state statute that prohibits taxing the oil industry at a rate higher than you tax the general public.
So that it did not happen then. The state of Alaska posed an objection to the city and Alyeska going forward?
Actually, we did pose the tax. We have taxed for 3 years, but that's been kept as a separate fund, and it's being challenged right now in the courts. Yeah.
So it was never used to accomplish the purposes of warehousing and accumulating this cleanup equipment?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if I know we've got a panel here, but I really am due at the White House, so I wonder if you could work out to entertain the questions from the committee on me. Then I can go to the White House and deal with this.
That's fair, Mr. Secretary. We'll do that right now. I'll start so that everyone will know. We'll start by recognizing the ranking member from Alaska. We'll go back to our chairman, and then we will go in the order which we left the round earlier. We will also recess at noon, so keep that in mind with your questions. We now recognize the gentleman from Alaska, Mr. Young.
Chairman, again, in deference to the other members, I will not ask that many questions. I'd like, though, Mr. Chairman, to thank the Secretary for his trip with Admiral Yost and, of course, Mr. Riley and their presentation and their conduct, and the President of the United States. I am a little concerned when some people are possibly thinking about using this for political reasons or use it for political purposes. I think that's a very misguided thing to do, and we appreciate your interest and your comments. I would suggest one thing, Mr. Secretary, as the Secretary over the Coast Guard, the smallest of all your children, that you properly feed that agency in your budget request, and I have talked to the President yesterday, and I am confident that will happen. I'm not saying this to you personally, Mr. Secretary. I'm just saying over the years, there's been a Tennessee mass transit has a better priority than the Coast Guard. And I have said the Coast Guard has been charged with tremendous responsibility, and yet this Congress has not funded it adequately, and in fact, the Secretary has not asked for the adequate funds. So that's just a little comment.
As you know, I have asked for additional funds, and I've asked that Amtrak and mass transit be cut back. So
thank you.
The chair now recognizes the chairman of our full committee, Mr. Johnson.
Chairman, the Secretary, it's a pleasure meeting you here today and look forward to future negotiations and conferences. But Secretary, the comprehensive oil spill bill, which I introduced 3 weeks ago with 41 co-sponsors, would have given a damage future negotiations and conferences. Asking for compensation from a federal fund if Exxon delayed in meeting these claims.
Introduced 3 weeks ago.
Under these circumstances, is it safe to assume that the Bush administration would support our comprehensive legislation?
We do support comprehensive legislation. The Reagan and Department of Transportation, while not sponsoring it, was intimately involved with the committee in doing it. As you know, it's a very difficult problem. We've got risk of international spills in the future, and there is no protection for the people of the United States on an international a spill by an international tanker. And that legislation is very far-reaching. We look forward to working with you on it. I told the Senate in my confirmation process, I look forward to working with them on it. We do have a disagreement, as you know, on preemption and the protocols. We feel very strongly that the protocols and an international agreement that's enforceable internationally is absolutely essential, and that the Exxon situation, as tragic as it is, would be even more tragic if we had not had a company with the wherewithal of Exxon to deal with this problem. So we must have that. We must have it soon. I think one of the results of this will be such legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Even more tragic. I want to echo the chairman's comments that we're going to be assisting him in every regard to move that legislation forward, and we would appreciate your agency's assistance in every respect. We'll now recognize the three remaining members of the subcommittee who have not yet had a chance to ask questions, and then we'll come back and alternate again. We recognize from Florida, Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Secretary, we've had testimony here today that there was a need on the part of average people or people in Alaska to some sort of emergency assistance like low rate loan. Are you going to ask the White House for a declaration of emergency so this can occur?
Well, we're going to find a program that's going to make sure that the people of Alaska are protected. If that's the best way, that's what we'll do. There's a couple of other alternatives that, frankly, may be more effective, and they're being discussed as well. I mean, my personal opinion, Congressman, is that if Exxon could put immediately post a fund under some kind of trustee of a significant amount, which would then process claims on a regular basis and possibly a loan fund of some type against those claims, that might be the quickest, most efficient way to do it. That might be, frankly, quicker and better than some government program, depending upon how it's implemented and how long it takes. So I think we got to find an answer to the solution. An answer to the problem, and that solution may be some private sector immediate demonstration of intent. If not, we'll have to go the federal route.
It's my recollection that when we have terrible frosts that kill off our oranges in Florida, or we have a hurricane, that the president declares an emergency. I remember going with Lyndon Johnson to Jacksonville, Florida, my hometown, right after Agnes had devastated our coastline. And I don't see a reason why the people of Alaska should be treated differently. And therefore, I think that something ought to be done with a greater sense of urgency, using the facilities that are now available. To invent a new method of doing it would seem to me to be not very kind to the people of Alaska. So I urge you very much to ask that emergency be declared and that you go under the laws that now exist, which allow low interest rates. They may be the real answer, because if the people borrow low interest rates, if they get a claim against the company later, then they'll be not too badly hurt. But if they wait for putting together a parcel, I'm afraid it might not occur. The next question I'd like to observe is as an erstwhile former lawyer, I listened to what I heard about the application. And the application, as I heard, said, were there any things that happened to you in your affairs with the government other than minor traffic accidents? Well, a person who's an alcoholic, I'm not an alcoholic, I never had a drink in my life, but any person who is an alcoholic is asked the question of whether he had any problems with the law other than minor traffic accidents, is going to make a DWI in that group that he doesn't have to report. Yeah, I think you have to ask him specifically if you've ever been charged with a DWI and what was the disposition of the case. And as I read the forms that get out from the government, they seldom ask it that way. They usually ask it a minor traffic accident. And any alcoholic is going to say, well, DWI is a minor traffic accident. So that ought to be corrected, and I think it ought to be done promptly.
I agree.
The third thing is a research matter. I'm not familiar with oil, really. I did hear words like dispersant, which sounds like just moving it around, out and getting it away. And then I heard something about absorbent. As a guy who's walked the beaches from early life of Florida and have seen the oil in its gelatinous state after it goes through the water of the sea, is any research underway to make oil harden and go to the bottom as a non-pollutant? That would seem to me to be the best answer, having stepped on all this oil in my youth and older days.
Yeah. The environmentalists tell us that by taking oil and sinking it, it causes more long-term environmental damage than if you use dispersants on the surface and dispel it. So I don't know.
Environmentalists and environmentalists, you know, what I'm talking about is research that might be able to contain. After all, there are people today who are taking the most horrible poisons and making it into things that do not poison the environment. That being so, since oil is not a horrible poison, it would seem to me to be some way to accelerate this coagulation and make it hit the bottom. And if it were like a rock and didn't actually hurt the water, it would seem to me that that would be a very good answer to oil.
I'll check on it, but it's the conventional wisdom, I understand, is by sinking it like you've spoken of, that causes more long-term damage. But I'll look at it, and I'll report back to you.
Thank you very much.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair will recognize again those subcommittee members who have not had a chance yet. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier, there was much discussion about the apparent cause of the accident in regard to the sobriety of the captain and his alcohol blood content, plus his conviction record and the like. And also there was some testimony by Admiral Yost that it's sort of a 10-mile wide channel, and I think I heard him on television say your child could drive a tanker up through there. Well, my question is, what was the condition of the other members of the crew? Were they tested for blood alcohol or drugs like the captain was?
That's my understanding. The other, the third mate and the second mate were tested, and they were clean, that they did not have an intoxication problem.
Okay. Secondly, there were some comments in the newspaper where some were trying to foist some responsibility on the Coast Guard, and there was an indication there were three members of the Coast Guard on duty that night, and they likewise were tested for alcohol. What were the results of those tests?
I haven't seen the results of those tests, but I don't think there's ever been an allegation that any of the people at the Coast Guard duty station were impaired in any way.
I wonder if the Admiral could give us the result of those tests.
And they likewise were the tested for alcohol. What were the results of those tests?
I haven't seen the results of those tests, but I don't think there's ever been an allegation that any of the people at the Coast Guard duty station were.
BTS watchstander who was tested a number of hours after he got off watch did have some alcohol in his blood. He had also just finished eating dinner with his wife, and they had a cocktail for dinner or something like that. I heard that.
Where was that blood alcohol content, the number?
I don't know, sir, but our people did, and those who investigated it up there on the scene did say that it was not related in any way, that his there was no impairment and no blood, no alcohol when he was on board.
What was that?
The pilot that left the ship, I understand, at 11:30 p.m., he was on the ship about 2 hours and a half or so. Did he make any observations in regard to the condition of the crew or the captain?
Let me say this. Congressman, the National Transportation Safety Board is charged with the responsibility of reporting on a full and complete investigation of this matter. They are the source. They are there at the request of the Coast Guard to conduct this investigation. They are the source of the facts rather than what we read in the newspaper and what may have been true. And it has been my practice, I'm trying to cooperate, but it has been my practice not to comment on investigations of the National Transportation Safety Board until they're over, because if you do that, you may be unfairly commenting, and frankly, you may be commenting on information that you don't have firsthand. We do not have, the National Transportation Safety Board shares information with us when their investigation is complete. They are an independent agency. And so I think we ought to, on that position, wait. I think we'll get a complete report. They're on it all over the place. And as soon as that preliminary report comes out, they'll render an oral report, and we'll share it with you. So I think it's dangerous to speculate on newspaper comments until I see the NTSB report.
Finally, there's been some discussion and some confusion in regard to whether or not the ship itself was within radar range. At one time, it was reported that it wasn't, and now it apparently is reported that it was. What is the official position of the Department of Transportation?
The issue is, number one, is it within range, and number two, is it under positive radar control? If I can equate it to aviation, if you file an instrument flight plan, you fly, you are under positive radar control, and that airplane is directed and guided by radar controllers. If you're under a visual flight rules, you are at your own pilotage. This ship was under VFR type conditions. They had a pilot on board who got off, who took them through the channel. They were in contact, and the radar did go down about as far as necessary to cover that point, but they were not under positive radar control. The Coast Guard was not and does not give directions on which direction to go, but it appears they may have been under range of the radar.
One final question. Are there any policies within the department in reference to dealing with the pilots on these ships, that they have any responsibility in reference to making observations in regard to the condition of the crew that they turn the ship over to?
That's a good question. Those are state pilots, but I think that that's something we're going to want to look at. They're an independent person on the ship who could give us an indication of any problems, and we should work a mechanism out with the state. If they see something, they should report it. I think that's an excellent observation.
Thank you.
Chair, I recognize the gentleman from Oklahoma, Mr. Inhofe.
Mr. Secretary, just one question. This morning, Admiral Yost gave rather lengthy and very excellent testimony. I know it's very early. No conclusions have been reached. But he used the term three times during his testimony that in response to the question of what caused it, he said there was a 7 to 10 minute lapse on the bridge when something inexplicable happened. Do you have any personal opinion as to what happened?
No, I think Exxon has recognized that it's a major act of negligence. You don't run into that reef in that water at 15 knots off course and off the wrong side of the buoys and on the wrong side of the channel without having some major negligence, whether it was an autopilot that was on, whether it was a mate that didn't have the proper experience or didn't know what he was doing. It clearly appears to be an act of significant negligence. The NTSB will give us a complete report, and I think we can sit here and speculate for some time, and one of those items of speculation will probably be it, but I think, we'll know soon enough. But it certainly is an act of negligence, severe negligence. The NTSB will give us a complete
report, and I think we can sit here. Thank you, sir. We'll now offer members of the full committee who are with us today a chance to ask a few questions. We'll start with the gentleman from California, Mr. Bosco. But it certainly
is an act of negligence. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, Admiral Yost wasn't as optimistic, at least I didn't think he was, as you are about the liability here. He testified that it wasn't outside the realm of possibility that the United States would be held liable for this accident. You seem very convinced that Exxon is admitting to it, willing to accept it, and can be held accountable to the people that the mayor and lieutenant governor have said need help right away. What if Exxon doesn't come forward within the next couple weeks with a substantial program to help these people? Are you prepared then to ask the SBA or other agencies of government to step in now and help these people?
Yes, the answer is we're going to explore alternatives. If the Exxon alternative isn't realistic or isn't, as I said, they don't put their money where their mouth is, which so far they have, then we're going to find an alternative. We're not going to allow the industry in Alaska to hang out to dry, period.
So the fishermen and others, business people in Valdez and elsewhere, can be assured that in a very short period of time, they will receive financial help, whether it be from Exxon or from the U.S. government, one way or another, that help will be forthcoming.
They're going to receive support. We've got to look at the alternatives as a backup.
Whether it be from Exxon or from the U.S. government, one way or another, that help will be forthcoming.
They're going to receive support. We've got to look at the alternatives as a backup. But if...